session number 11928, rule 7.
Mr. Ian Fraser, rule 7.
So, I said to this subject, well, I do wish to see the signal officer, and he said, well, you'll have to put in a request to see him. Meantime, you're wasting your own time getting off in leave. I said, well, I'm not prepared to do that. And so the next day I had to, they duly were quite good. They rushed it a bit. I saw the signal officer the next morning in his office. He was the nearest I'd get to the man in charge. He was a commander. Very nice chap, and he listened to. He actually listened. I told him the whole story again. The guys were here 3.5 years ago, and they're still here. He said, "Well, they could be disabled, or they could be entertainment stuff." I said, "Entertainments." Well, I told him what I thought they were, and he said, "Well, tell me what you've been doing." So I told him. Well, he said, "Yes." Let me think about this. He said, "Anyway, you go on leave. And I'll sort something out for you." Well, from a man of that character, okay, yes, off I went, quite happy on my week's leave. I hadn't been home 2 days in Bramcote. There was a telegram. Lanka cancelled, leave extended to 3 weeks. On return, report to this office, which I did. Reported to this same chappy. He happened to be in the office, and he said, "We've had a chat about this, Fraser," and he said, "We're going to send you to HMS Africander." Well, I happened to know where Africander was. I nearly jumped down his throat, because Africander was Durban. So admittedly, still a possible jumping off spot for Japan, but Durban was different to Lanka. Durban was Durban, and always will be, in a way. So I then... got the old HMS, SS, I should say, Franconia, from Liverpool to Port Said. The interesting thing was, while I was on board the Franconia, going down the river, Mersey, was my old ship setting off on one of her trips. So I gave her a wave. I don't suppose anybody saw me on a big trooper. But that was the last I saw of her. And I did do a painting of her as she slid past us, and I've still got that painting, one of my personal library paintings. And then from Port Said we entrained to Ismailia, however you like to pronounce it. I heard it pronounced half a dozen different ways by the English, because it's, being an Arabic name, it's not easily come by to get it. It's the other end of the Gulf anyway, the other end of the canal, I should say. And then I got this Polish trooper, which I think I described to you earlier. The Kosciuszko. That thing full of cockroaches. And on board there, I sort of did painting and organised quizzes, and there were quite a few of us. And I had the great pleasure on this trip, for the first time in my life. Had some lousy food through nobody's fault. But we started to get served up goat meat. This goat meat was rotten. It was definitely off. It was stinking. You could smell it. And there was an army officer. A single pip came along on this second day with me having it. And any complaints, you men? And we'd been talking about this. I said, yes, sir. This meal is not edible. Oh, he picked it up, sniffed at it, and said, "Oh, well, that's nothing wrong with that, as far as I can see, putting it on a bit, you see." And, I said, "Well, I suggest, sir, you eat it. If you think there's nothing wrong with it, it's no good smelling it. We can smell it from here. You eat it." And, you know, I swear, the fellow that went, the colour of that, and he sort of hummed and hawed and said to the sergeant, "Carry on, sergeant. Next mess," and that was the end of that. We didn't get rotten meat anymore. Whatever they did with that goat, it went over the side. But that's just the sort of interesting little thing that could happen. Another one was on that trip, we're offered shore leave in Kilindini, which was the port for Mombasa, and just a bus ride up the road, Mombasa. And you couldn't get ashore unless you'd had a yellow fever injection, which I hadn't had. And I thought, well, I'll settle down to do a bit of painting of the harbour, which I did. I've still got some paintings I did then. And a lot of chaps, they hadn't been jabbed, but the sick bay attendant, for a consideration, was offering to give them an injection. And everybody had a pay book in the Navy, and all your inoculations and subs you'd got and borrowing money from the Admiralty and anything of that description went on the back of this pay book stamp. Way these guys went ashore, when they came back, they all landed up in the brig, in the ship's jail, in other words. And what had happened was the sick bay attendant, I mean, they shouldn't have listened to him. What he'd done, he'd written on the book in his own handwriting, inoculation for yellow fever, and the date. The Navy don't work that way. It's an Admiralty fleet order, and it was AFO number so and so. Bang, stamp, and the date. So that they came back and they spent the rest of the time in jail, and they were charged when they got to Durban. I mean, they're just foolish of them. It was a serious offence to. I mean, what happened to the sick bay attendant? I don't know. He probably got 6 months or something like that for doing it. But the rest didn't come off lightly because they spent the time in the brig. But that was foolish of them. They should have known it was an AFO. I would have known it was an AFO, and they should have known it was an AFO anyway. That was it. So we finally arrived at going down. We were an 8-knot convoy, and we escorted the Valiant. Now the Valiant had been bombed in Alexandria Harbour. In actual fact, there was a film made about it with John Mills. I think it was called The Valiant. And she was bombed in dry dock, but she settled on an even keel, and the commander of her, to fool the Germans and the Italians, of course, in Alexandria, he had the marine band out marching and carried on normal duties on the deck, as they would if there were nothing wrong with them. And in fact, the bottom was blown out of the ship in parts, but she was floating in this dry dock. They let the water out, and she settled on the dry dock evenly. So it appeared from the air that she wasn't damaged. And she was. And they patched her up, and she was going to go to... she was going to go to... via Durban to UK to be broken up. And it's only just recently I found out that she did not go to Durban. She didn't get broken up, but she was recommissioned with another crew and sent into service again. And I understand that the crew were not at all amused. In fact, something very nasty happened to the commander of the ship when it was recommissioned, because the whole crew expected to be going home to be broken up, therefore they'd get leave in another ship, and they were recommissioned in Durban. So there you are. That's one of the things I found out most recently from a commander gunnery officer who I'm going to do a painting of the diadem for.
What exactly happened to the commander?
Well, in this letter I got, I think somebody dropped something on him from a great height, according to my information. Odd things happen to sea. But that is true. Anyway, we arrived at Durban, and I went in, was assigned to HMS Africander, which I say was the base camp. It wasn't a ship, just a handling camp. And I'd been there about 24 hours, and Chief Buffer sent for me. That's chief police in the Navy, Chief Buffer. That's a nickname they give him, Chief Regulating Officer, who was a Chief Bill, although they call him a Regulating Officer. In this case he was only a Chief, but he's still got the same powers. He was the policeman in charge. So he said to me, "You drive all right, Fraser?" I said, "Yeah." drive chief. He said, well, take the 5-tonner out. And he said, tonight I want you to go to an address. He said, remove all the tools from the toolbox, which is on the left-hand side, under the left-hand side seat. I said, oh, yes, right. So I did this. And he said, then report back to me. He said, I want you to take this truck out on its own. And he said, this is what I want you to do. And he handed me a list. And he said, I want you to go to this address. It's a lady friend of mine. She runs this this booth shop in Durban. He said, I want you to load it up. And they've got a list. He got a dozen bottles of orange gin, a dozen bottles of lemon gin, brandy, you name it. The whole thing, it was a list this long. I said, yeah, that's all right, chief, but what about the sentry on the gate when I come back? I said, it's all right going out, of course. Oh, he said, don't worry about the sentry on the gate, you drive straight through. Just say Chief Buffer's orders. So I went down, I collected all this booze, and it was a very big toolbox on a 5-ton truck, loaded all this stuff in, and I think it was a bit of a bordello, this place, actually. I got that impression, you know, a sort of wine shop come friend of the Chief Buffer's and all the rest of this woman, very nice woman, about 40, something like that. Get back to the gates, really shaking like a leaf, because I wasn't too sure of this. I daren't disobey the Chief Buffer. Obviously, he got me. He really got me by the short and curlies, imagine. He tells me to do a thing, I've got to do it. Get to the gates, and there's a sentry there. I said, Chief Buffer. He said, carry on, mate. That was it. Drove up to his, he's got a nice little chalet. Delivered the stuff. Oh, and he said, by the way, come back when you return the truck. So I went back, and he said, what hut are you in? Because we messed in huts there. I told him. He said, well, it's 3 bottles of orange, 3 bottles of lemon, and 3 bottles of brandy for you. Just spit among the lads with my compliments. And that was the gentleman, you see. So it always shows you that the sort of thing that went on. I mean, from the chief of police down to me conniving with him to the lads drinking the stuff. I suppose they could have been charged with drinking it if the truth was known, if you looked up the King's regulation. But however, that was one very interesting little anecdote. And then the next day they wanted to see me in the regulating office, drafting office, whatever, as well. And he was there, and he said, we're looking for the man with the highest marks we've got in WT. And he said they wanted a PO if possible, but we haven't got a PO handy, and you being a leading flagger fish, you'll have to do it. Get all your gear together and report to this address. Well, this address was a place called Durban Radio, and it was 5 miles outside Durban itself, 15 by train. And what it was a GPO shipshore radio station, nothing naval. And had been seconded from the Navy to the GPO. When I arrived, they saw to me, and everybody wore civvies, so I hadn't got any civvies then, but I soon found some, obviously. And they said, well, the next morning, report to the GPO behind the main railway station, backed on one another, the GPO, very large building, and report to Mr. So-and-so, and we want you to undergo a test. Well, the test they gave me was first-class Postmaster General certificate in WT. In the handbook of wireless telegraphy for the Navy, the first page, when you open volume one, it's in two volumes. You've got volume one and volume two, and they're both light green in colour. They're in fact collector's items, that particular volume. And the first page is solid calculus. That is the first page you open. I mean, you know all the rest up to calculus, and it carries on from there. This is the technical side of it. The two volumes are just purely technical. So they said, right, you've been in the Navy. I said, yes, I'm pretty good, I suppose. Well, they said, we'll find out about if you're good enough for the GPO. And I was in there all day. Instead of half an hour sending and receiving, it was an hour sending and an hour receiving at 25 words a minute, which was the same as the Navy, but I hadn't done any sending as long as that for ages. Not consistently. Plain language, to change it from plain language to cipher to, swapping it backwards and forwards with a break after the hour sending, then receiving for an hour. And then the rest of the afternoon was taken up with the technical side of it. And it came about 5 o'clock. I said to the superintendent in charge there, how did it go? He said, oh, you passed. I said, you're all right. You fit in with my mob. He said, you'll do. Technically, you're good. And that was it. And I passed this first-class postmaster general certificate, which would have entitled me to go to sea as a radio officer after the war if I'd so wished. But I'd had enough of the sea by then, I thought. And that was the start of it, and I spent just about a year there. And it was very, very nice because it was off with the uniform. Soon Russell Round had got me some civvies, and we used to go ashore at night to the nightclubs, do the nightclubs, and we used to fit our own watches. The superintendent there of the station, he said, I don't mind how you organise things as long as the station is run as a GPO station should be efficiently. And instead of doing 4 hours on and 8 off, we used to do about a week on and 2 weeks off. In other words, there were enough of us. Each operator had his own bay with windows in it, clocks all over the place, different times in the world, although we worked on GMT. And on the technical side, the signals were so powerful, to avoid feedback from the transmitter. The transmitter was sighted 5 miles away, the transmitting mast and the transmitting equipment, 5 miles away from the receiving station, to prevent any feedback, magnetically or otherwise, back to your receiver. The key was heavily insulated. I never did find out what power we put out, because the masts were... I don't know if you've seen any of the old type of radio masts. They're about... you're looking at about 300 feet, something like 200, 300 feet, and they're just an array of them, about 6, 7, 8. And they could be seen for miles, of course. But
when was it that you were doing this job for the GPO in Durban?
Just as soon as I did a few days, did this little job for the chief buffer running the spirits and all the rest of it. Then the next day they sent for me. And that was it. From then on, I was detached from Africanda, and I was I was actually on Durban Radio.
So this was 45, was it?
1945? Yes, it's. It was 19. Let me think. It would be from the 31st of October 44 to the 21st of September 45. That would be the date, so it's just about a year.
So when did you arrive in Durban?
I arrived in Durban on arrived in Durban on the 31st of October 44, and I left on the 7th of September 45. Anyway, I have to think about those dates. The thing was, I spent about a year on that station. One funny thing happened. To go back to the technical side, to transmit, one had to pick up a phone up the superintendent of the transmitting station, tell him to start the generators and give you a certain frequency, and all one had in the particular bay you were working in was a receiver. You had no transmitter. You had the key, of course, but that was all controlled from 5 miles away. So all you did was tune in your radio, and the frequency would be set for you within limits at the other end, and then you just banged away on the key. There was regarding that side of it, the war finished. They dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, and everybody went mad, particularly on the merchant ships. And they said, well, the war's over, and the Yanks were returning to wherever, the States presumably, from the Far East. And all the radio operators shut down the stations and stuck a record on. I'll never forget it. They all played the record Sentimental Journey Back Home. And they just opened the spirit lockers, and you couldn't get in touch with a ship. And we were a ship shore station. We couldn't work shore to shore. We could only work a ship. We weren't allowed to work anybody else. And you couldn't get through. And then there was a destroyer who sent us a signal. One of the islands off Japan said she was going in to take water and whatever else. And we knew that island was full of Japs. We knew ourselves from our information. And I was trying, and the other chaps in the bays, the other officers, were trying to get through. And these darn merchantmen were jamming the frequency with this Sentimental Journey tune on the gramophone record. But finally we did get through a bit late, because by that time he'd entered the inlet to this island, and they'd fired at him and killed quite a few chaps on board. With that, he took off himself. He didn't bother to for our warning, but that was the sort of thing that happened. The war was never over, really, and I think years after, they were still finding odd islands with Japanese still in charge. In fact, I think it was only recently, wasn't it? There was one man still alive, about 90-odd, and he still wouldn't believe the war was over. He was on his own on this island. I think it was in the newspapers, I know. Another interesting thing was, I mean, it was so different from the Russian run. You know, here that was sheer hell, and here there was all the fruit and steaks and salmon and you name it. It really was some recompense for the 3 years and more in the North Atlantic and the Brent Sea and whatever. But one night, quite a, shows you how the things went. One of the other guys said to me, I've got a motorcycle, which I knew. Let's go to the nightclub tonight. So I said, yeah, fine. He said, well, we'll change into our tuxes at my house. He was a son of a local undertaker. And quite a nice chap, very friendly with him. So we got on the back of this bike. It's, as I say, it was 15 miles to Durban. Sputtered to a stop. I said, oh, out of petrol, any important petrol. He said, don't worry about petrol. He said, go in that saddlebag. He said, fetch me a couple of bottles of brandy out. I said, what? He said, just bring me 2 bottles of brandy. He put these in the tank. And he said, hang on, just hang on. And he said, and the damn thing, he took off, it raw alcohol in it, you know, sort of thing. It didn't worry him at all. You can imagine pouring, I mean, if it runs on brandy, what was the brandy like? Well, that's true. We got to his house and changed, and of course, we went to this, we're always going to nightclubs, and very enjoyable too. The one thing about that, I didn't bother going much on the lot of South African naval ships in. But I was so fed up with the naval routine, and so glad to get into the atmosphere of GPO, that I never bothered to go on board one of the South African ships at all. I'd lost interest in not in the job I was doing, but in the atmosphere of the Navy. And then after a year, when everything was up. The jig was up, you might say, for the Japanese, and I was in Class A, which meant first in, first out, so one of the first in, one of the first out. And I went then to a place called Clava Camp, which was a signal school in Cape Town from Durban. I'd leave the radio station after about a year, go back to Africander, fill in the forms and get the train tickets to Cape Town. And there again, it's such amazing countryside, so beautiful. But one thing did strike me very particularly was that the marvellous vineyards, because the South African wine is quite well known, and they're all terraced on hills. And we had, as far as the train took a very long route, it went from Durban to Joburg, that was electrified via Pietermaritzburg, which is the capital, the university town, I should say, of
Natal,
because a lot of people think Durban, well, it's not the Pietermaritzburg is the capital of Natal. A lot of people don't know that. They say Durban, you know, but Durban is not. It's officially the university town is about 40 miles away, through a place called the Valley of a Thousand Hills. Marvellous place, straight highway, and you've got all these hills on either side of the road. Marvellous. Anyway, the train I took, it called at, it went through Pietermaritzburg and called at Joburg, and there were all the hills of gold dust, the extraction from the mines, sort of glittering in the sun. You know, it wouldn't be worth them collecting here. It wouldn't be lying there, but it, as they extracted the ore, it was yellowish, the actual residue from the ore. As you get a coal tip, and you used to have old coal tips, probably recall those, and before they started spreading them out, and they were there. Then we changed to a steam train, and I didn't know why. I hadn't got a clue, and found out the reason afterwards was because the line we were going to take then had to be narrow gauge for a certain duration, because we were going to go around these mountains as near as a direct route as we could. And I think British engineers had designed this lot. But the most fantastic thing was, apart from the beautiful countryside, the lush green, the vineyards, the flowers, the bougainvillea, the jacaranda, was on one occasion I looked out the carriage window and I looked down and I could see the rear portion of the train, the guard's van and all the rest of it. As a matter of interest, I went to the other side of the coach and looked up, and there was the engine hauling us. So you can imagine what it was, 2'6" narrow gauge, if I recall. You can imagine what a sort of circuit he was taking. It was a very long train, I admit, for wartime. But there, if you look down from where you are, you see the rear of the train, you look up and you see the engine going that way. Amazing. Shows you, gives you an idea of how the route was. Then I arrived at Cape Town, and the usual thing, the signal schools, HMS Clava was some miles out at Simonstown, which was a naval base, still is. Well, I think we've got a base there, haven't we, still? And it was a case then of more or less there were no duties really. It was a matter of waiting to get passage home. That was all there was to it. And things were pretty hectic with organising, getting rid of everybody to UK. But there was one very interesting thing re-